This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 6th, 2013. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. At the Port of Portland on Saturday, Columbia Grain Company locked out members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Over 50 workers gathered outside the terminal gates on Saturday in a peaceful protest against the lockout. Some workers held signs with the word unfair written in bold letters. A contract between the union members and the Pacific Northwest Grain Handlers Association expired last September. Unable to reach an agreement by the end of the year, the two signs were forced to operate under the previous contract terms. Columbia Grain accuses workers of engaging in what they call inside game tactics, which include slowing down operations and demanding repeated inspections of equipment. The Pacific Northwest Grain Handlers Association claims that union perks cost the company millions of dollars per year. But the workers say Columbia Grain is a highly profitable foreign company, which is solely interested in increasing profits. Despite the somewhat misleading name, Columbia Grain is actually managed by the Japanese trading company, Marubeni. The president of the local Longshore Workers Union claims that Columbia Grain never intended to reach an agreement. The company has also hired an out-of-state strike-breaking firm with attorneys and publicists to make allegations against the workers. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was at the protest at the fort on Saturday and brings us this story.
So I'm out here on the picket line talking with
Latea Daly.
And Latea, why are you out here today?
Well, I'm a mother of two, and I live in the St. John's community, and I'm really concerned about the effect it will have. I know that a lot of longshoremen live in the St. John's area, and if they lose their jobs, I'm worried how that will affect the local businesses in the area and our schools that they donate to. I think that since my tax monies pay for these ports and for these companies to work here, that we should get good jobs in return. And I see this company coming in with armed guards, taking jobs from workers, so that the companies can bring in cheaper workers.
Those are supporters honking as they go by the picket line.
So they can bring in workers for cheaper without benefits and work them part-time, which means my tax money will have to pay for their health care. And right now, I know that longshoremen have good jobs, and I don't understand why our port is allowing this to happen, why our local government is allowing this to happen. It's pretty disgusting.
Well, this is the first time that non-ILWU, non-union workers have unloaded and loaded grain at this terminal since 1934. It's been almost 80 years now. What's the significance of this?
Well, we have the longshoremen that have worked these terminals for generations. They have the experience. And if we can have a company from a different country hire another union busing company from out of state to come and bust these jobs, it's going to have a significance for other workers, because who wouldn't be next? I mean, if they can do this effectively to an organized union, they're going to be doing it to workers everywhere in this country. So really, we need to be asking ourselves whose job is going to be forcibly taken from them next.
Thank you very much, Latea Daly, concerned community member out here on the picket line with the locked out members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Jamie Partridge, KBOO News.
Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will hold a public hearing on the third round of proposals for West Haden Island tomorrow. The city first passed a resolution calling for proposals for the island, 9 miles north of downtown Portland, in July of 2010. Previous draft proposals have been controversial because environmental groups want to maintain a wildlife preserve there, while international corporations have called on the city to use West Haden Island to expand the Port of Portland. The current proposal designates 300 acres for industrial use, 650 acres for forest, and more than 500 acres for publicly accessible open space. But environmental groups like the Portland Audubon Society say that this could change the character of the island forever and put endangered species at risk. The Bureau has outlined a series of recommendations on recreation, transportation, health, and environmental issues, which will be discussed at the hearing on Tuesday. The current proposal still faces criticism from both sides of the aisle, leaving the future of West Haden Island unclear. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales, a key player in the decision, has not committed to plans for West Haden Island, calling any action dependent on the future of the Columbia River Crossing Bridge, which was recently approved by the state legislature.
President Obama has set an October deadline for terms and conditions on how the Trans-Pacific Partnership will work between the 11 countries that have been discussing it for 3 years. The Oregon Fair Trade Campaign is hosting a People's Assembly this Saturday to oppose what's becoming commonly referred to as NAFTA on steroids. Their director, Elizabeth Fonger, spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about the day's agenda and the importance of challenging the secretive nature of these negotiations.
We are holding the Portland People's Assembly on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is an event that's happening on May 11th, just prior to the new round of TPP negotiations in Peru. We are calling on the 99% who are harmed by corporate globalization. That includes small farmers, that includes people living with AIDS, that includes people who want to fight for a clean environment and public health for all. So we're calling on them to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this event is actually happening on International Fair Trade Day, and it's part of a global movement. There's going to be events like this happening throughout the world in different countries that are a party to the negotiations. So, you know, there's events in Lima, there's events in Sydney, Ontario, and many other cities and towns around the world. And people are calling out for an end to corporate greed and for fair trade, some alternatives to this free trade model that has been really just trade deals that benefit only corporations at the expense of people.
Can you tell me what's on the agenda of activities with regard to your presentation?
So we're going to start off with speakers panel, and we have a really great lineup of speakers. We'll start off with talking about how this trade deal is going to impact workers, not just here, but throughout the world. And Barbara Bird from Oregon AFL will be sharing some of her insights there. Then we're going to hear from Ann Picard, who's from Portland Area Global AIDS Coalition. And she's going to talk about one of the chapters that has been leaked from the TPP, because keep in mind, this is one of the most secretive trade negotiations to date. You know, the text is kept from the general public, but at the same time, there's 600 corporations that have access to the text and the negotiators. So Anne's going to be talking to us about the impact of intellectual property rights, specifically looking at how Big Pharma is pushing for language to extend the life of drug patents and how that's going to impact people living with HIV in developing countries. Then we'll hear from Benjamin Giritz from Positive Force Northwest, and he's going to talk to us about how the intellectual property chapter is going to impact people living with AIDS here in our community. Then we'll have a special guest Skype in from Peru, and he's an environmental justice leader, and he will be talking to us about another chapter that's been leaked. There's been two chapters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that have been leaked to the public, and the other one is looking at investor rights. In the past, with the Peru-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, there has been a case where a U.S. corporation opened up a smelter in a small town in Peru, and the corporation had agreed to make sure that they clean up any pollution as a result of their production. Instead of doing that, they polluted the town, and many children were being born with neurological diseases that's a result of the lead poisoning. When the government insisted that the company clean up their mess and would not issue them a permit, this U.S. company took a case against the Peruvian government to an international tribunal using the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. So that is the legacy of these trade deals. Now, the panel is going to be followed by a breakout group, and we'll be talking about the issues that were discussed, and we'll be planning for next steps. So not just let's talk about the problems, but what can we do about it? Saturday, May 11th. It's from 1 until 4 p.m. The speakers panel will be about an hour, and it's at the First Unitarian Church, and that's at Southwest 12th Avenue and Main Street.
This is Robin Ryan for KBOO News.
According to the Oregonian's recent study of the Portland hiring process, more than half of the city's executive positions are filled without a recruitment process. The salaries of these city officials range from $125,000 to $185,000 a year. Four of the five positions that pay over $175,000 were filled without any recruitment process. In January of 2012, the position for the Director of Internal Business Services unexpectedly opened, only to be filled almost immediately by Bryant Enge. With a salary of $147,000, resistance developed to his recent appointment. Critics say Enge landed the job due to a connection with Portland city officials. The lack of recruiting for high-paid positions in the city of Portland differs from comparable cities such as San Jose and Sacramento, who almost always go through a highly competitive recruitment process.
The Oregon legislature is debating whether or not to change some of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws created in the 1990s. These laws have cost the state millions with little impact on public safety, and a new poll shows a majority of voters agree that at least some of the changes outlined by House Bill 3194 are needed. KBOO's Sarah Sneath, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, has the story.
One of the big remaining tasks for Oregon lawmakers is deciding what to do with the recommendations from the Governor's Commission on Public Safety. A new poll offers some clues about how their constituents might handle it. 600 Oregon voters were asked just last week if they support or oppose specific reforms. From shortening three of the 20 mandatory minimum sentences to letting people earn time off a sentence for completing education and treatment programs. Those polled favor the changes, about 2-1. Representative Chris Garrett, who was on the governor's commission, thinks the poll shows a shift in thinking in recent years.
Oregonians are very comfortable with the idea of trading a little bit of length of time in prison if it means we can free up resources for all the other parts of the public safety system, including policing, that we are underfunding now because of the growth in the cost of prison.
Garrett predicts the biggest challenge to passing the sentence reforms will be the two-thirds supermajority required in both House and Senate. Mandatory minimum sentences have been in place since the 1990s, and the supermajority is needed because the original law was the result of a ballot measure. A couple of the poll questions involved how Oregon handles juvenile offenders. The committee recommended giving judges more discretion in whether to sentence a young person as an adult and to revisit a conviction midway through their sentence. Shannon White with the Partnership for Safety and Justice says in the poll, these changes received the highest amount of support.
There is strong support for reforms to the ways youth are automatically put into the adult criminal justice system by our mandatory minimum laws. And Oregonians really seem to recognize that youth are capable of positive growth and our system needs to provide an opportunity to rehabilitate and transform.
White says her organization commissioned the poll to determine if Oregonians are willing to invest more in crime prevention instead of on prison growth and spending. The people polled were fairly evenly divided between conservative, moderate, and liberal when asked about their political leanings. For KBOO News, I'm Sarah Sneath.
The Oregon State Senate today approved a measure allowing drivers to use an electronic version of their insurance card. This means that drivers who are pulled over by the police can pull up their proof of insurance on a smartphone or a tablet without needing a paper copy in their glove box. The bill was already passed unanimously by the House and now moves to the governor for his signature. Also in the state legislature today, a bill authorizing youth to obtain mental health services without parental consent passed the House Health Care Committee. Several people testified at the committee hearing, and here's a sample of the testimony.
My name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor. I'm speaking today as the president of COPACT, which is the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy. We're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 491, which allows licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to provide mental health services to adolescent clients on the same basis as other licensed practitioners. Current statute allows a teen 14 years of age or older to consent to outpatient mental health or chemical dependency treatment services. Under Oregon law, a physician, psychologist, a nurse practitioner, or a licensed clinical social worker is authorized to provide those services to consenting teens. Senate Bill 491 would simply add licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to current law. Teens seek help for a variety of issues such as drug or alcohol abuse, depression, anxiety, or suicidal behavior. Some teens desperately in need of help can face challenges to getting that help. Sadly, some parents are emotionally or sexually abusive or neglectful, or they may face problems of their own, such as alcoholism or drug dependence. Or following a divorce, the conflict between parents can leave teens caught between a custodial and a non-custodial parent. All of these can create barriers for their teens seeking permission to get help.
My name is Wendy Curtis, and I'm a licensed professional counselor in private practice, and I'm here today to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 491. Prior to having my own private practice, I worked at a mental health agency for 4 years as a youth addictions counselor. I saw adolescents ages 13 through 18, along with their families, for issues such as substance abuse and dependence, mood disorders including depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues that many adolescents struggle with. In 2007, nearly 1 in 12 8th graders and 1 in 16 11th graders reported they had attempted suicide in the past 12 months. It is of utmost importance that we make sure teens have full access to quality mental health care. I ask for your support for Senate Bill 491.
My name is Tim Cowan, and I'm testifying as an individual. I think there needs to be a method whereby a parent can request, or if they have a disagreement with the evaluation, what process do they have that they can consider? I want to know how holding the care provider harmless, how that affects accountability. Is there a way that a second or third party evaluation can be made to ensure that the primary evaluation is the best?
The bill passed the Health Care Committee and now moves to the full Oregon State House for approval.
A bill that would give local governments the power to regulate abandoned properties and foreclosure is being considered in the state Senate after passing the House last month. Referred to as the Good Neighbor Bill by sponsor Representative Lou Frederick, it entitles governments the ability to secure a property, evicting squatters or other trespassers after 30 days' notice is given to the property's owner. The bill for any action the government would take would be counted as a lien on the property, collected at the time of the property sale. Additionally, the requirement for banks who repossess property is to post contact information and share it with neighborhood associations, specifically targeting nuisance properties such as long vacant homes with unclear ownership that fall into disrepair or are getting squatted in. Efforts are being made to monitor the spread of unused foreclosed homes. Studies have shown that more than half of Oregon's 2,300 foreclosures are sitting empty, with a national survey conducted by RealtyTrack indicating that almost 45% of American foreclosures fail to list a forwarding address. In Portland, activists have confronted police in an effort to resist foreclosures and move families into vacant homes. At a sit-in in Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in January, elicited a response from Sheriff Dan Station to investigate the possibility of a moratorium on foreclosures.
According to New York's Attorney General Eric T. Schneiderman, Wells Fargo and Bank of America violated the terms of last year's $26 billion mortgage settlement. Schneiderman threatened to sue for compliance after citing over 300 violations in his notification to the Mortgage Settlements National Committee. Five of the nation's biggest banks and 49 attorney generals participated in the national mortgage settlement, which was intended to protect homeowners from foreclosure by improving servicing standards. Under the five-bank agreement, banks are obligated to respond to homeowners' mortgage notification requests within 30 days. According to the Associated Press, Schneiderman said Monday that delays by Wells Fargo and Bank of America put homeowners further into debt, pushing them towards foreclosure. According to the Associated Press, the New York Attorney General's office said in February that over 21,000 homeowners had received assistance from the five banks, including $1.2 billion in principal reductions and refinancing.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. Tonight's show features David Cobb, a former Green Party presidential candidate, speaking on the movement for a constitutional amendment revoking his corporate personhood. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. In tonight's show, students from Portland Youth Builders at Alternative High School provide their perspective on incarceration. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to start off a little cloudy, but gradually become increasingly sunny, highs near 75 degrees. Tomorrow evening should see an overcast night sky with lows around 51.
It is 5:24 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
You see them in stores across our country and around the world. Colorful and stylish clothing with happy-sounding brand names like Children's Place, Papaya, Joe Fresh, Freestyle Baby, and Mango. But you don't see the factories where these cheerful garments are made, nor are we shown the strained faces of the impoverished workers who make them, paid little more than a dollar a day for long, hard shifts. We only catch a glimpse of the grim reality sewn into these happy brands when yet another factory is in the news for collapsing or burning down, bringing a grotesque death to hapless workers trapped inside. It's a horror that keeps happening. And after each one, the brand name marketers and retail profiteers cluck with sympathy for the families of the dead and decry the tragic accident. As Scott Nova of the Workers' Rights Consortium put it after the recent atrocity when a Bangladesh factory collapsed and crushed thousands of garment workers, the response is always the same, vague promises and public relations dodges, while the pile of corpses grows even higher. Is there something about clothing factories that makes them disaster magnets? Yes, the massive gravitational pull of corporate greed. Not merely the greed of sleazy factory owners, but most significantly, the greed of such respectable retailers as Walmart, Benetton, Gap, and H&M. The April collapse in Bangladesh was not an accident, but the inevitable result of a Western business model that demands such low prices from offshore suppliers that worker safety is their dead last priority. This is Jim Hightower saying, in the corporate hierarchy, death is coldly built into the consumer price and routinely accepted in the boardrooms as a justifiable means of adding another dime to the bottom line. For information and action, go to www.workersrights.org. Workersrights.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This past weekend marked the anniversary of the killings of four students at Kent State University by National Guard soldiers in 1970. And this year, for the first time, the United Nations Human Rights Commission has agreed to review the case to determine if the students were deliberately targeted. 3 years ago, on the 40th anniversary of the Kent State killings, KBOO News broke a news story that was later covered by numerous media outlets. A survivor of the Kent State killings came to KBOO with newly remastered recordings of the May 4, 1970 demonstration. New digital technology allowed the tapes to be more closely monitored, and the words, "Ready, aim, fire," were audible in the background. This brought into question the U.S. government's claim that the soldiers were not given an order to shoot. The United Nations claim was filed by the younger sister of Allison Cross, a freshman honor student that was killed in the 1970 attack. Her father filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government the day after Allison was killed, which remains open until this day. He has refused to settle the lawsuit despite several offers from the U.S. government to pay him money in order to close the case. Cross has repeated on each occasion that he's not interested in money. He simply wants justice for his daughter's death.
A plan to sell land adjacent to the site of the Wounded Knee Massacre is sparking controversy between members of the Sioux Nation. Wounded Knee is the site where hundreds of Sioux people were massacred by U.S. cavalry in 1890 and is within the confines of the Pine Ridge Reservation. The reservation is also the site of an armed insurrection led by the American Indian Movement in 1973, when a shootout between the group and the FBI left three people dead. The owner of the land is looking for nearly $4 million in exchange for the property and has put the area on public auction after Native tribes failed to raise the money. The tribe believes that the going rate for the land is closer to $20,000. However, the sale of the land at Wounded Knee is not the only contentious issue on the agenda. Other issues include a proposed horse slaughterhouse and the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is slated to travel through tribal land. The slaughterhouse is being pushed by members of tribal leadership who want to bring development to the reservation. One of the largest tribes in the nation, its people have been subject to crippling poverty, with unemployment on the reservation standing at 80%, as well as an infant mortality rate 3 times higher than the U.S. national average. Proponents of the slaughterhouse say that facility would provide roughly 150 new jobs, and its revenue would be untouched by U.S. taxation. Slaughterhouse opponents say that horses are sacred to the Sioux people and that the reservation would be an inappropriate place for the facility. The prospect of the Keystone XL pipeline has sparked protests at Pine Ridge, with the natives erecting blockades in opposition to the project.
Military Judge Colonel Denise Lynn has ruled that a pretrial hearing for Army Private First Class Bradley Manning this Wednesday will be closed for national security reasons. Pretrial hearings are rarely held behind closed doors, and the security surrounding the case has led to considerable controversy. The military has withheld from public court filings and rulings throughout the prosecution of Manning for releasing classified documents to the whistleblowing site WikiLeaks. The secret session has been described as a dry run to test the viability of a public trial for Manning, despite the amount of evidence deeming classified by the government. Jesselyn Raddick, Director of National Security and Human Rights Director for the Government Accountability Project, called the dry run a dress rehearsal for a secret trial. The Center for Constitutional Rights has questioned the extreme lack of transparency in Manning's case, filing an unsuccessful lawsuit last month. Although Judge Lynn is adamant about keeping most of the pretrial secret, she suggested that the pretrial may be partially open to the public. Prosecutor Maj Aston Fain opposes the partially closed trial, saying that because over half of the 141 witnesses will be discussing classified information necessitated over the third of the trial be closed. Among other options available are the use of written documents or other code words to avoid entering a classified information into public record. Manning's trial will be held on June 3rd. He's being tried for 22 offenses, including espionage and aiding the enemy, and could face up to 20 years in prison, or possibly a life sentence. He pleaded guilty in February to minor charges, although a plea deal was rejected by prosecutors, and further charges are still being pursued.
Almost 2 weeks after the collapse of an 8-story garment factory in Bangladesh, the death toll has now surpassed 675. Rana Plaza building, located in the capital, Dhaka, contained 5 textile factories that produced clothing for Western brands. New Wave Styles, one of the garment factories, allowed workers to begin their shifts despite the large cracks in the building. An architect from the firm that designed the building says that Rana Plaza was originally constructed to be a shopping mall and not an 8-story industrial building. Officials claim that the building owner illegally added 3 additional floors in order to accommodate generators for garment factories. Investigators claim that the vibrations from the generators and other machinery contributed to the collapse of the building. The Bangladeshi police have arrested New Wave Styles owner and a local government engineer involved in the construction of the building. The local police chief says they will investigate possible murder charges. And in Bangladesh, a murder charge can lead to the death sentence.
On Saturday in the northern city of Chihuahua, Mexico, gunmen shot and killed the sons of 2 well-known Mexican journalists. According to witness statements, the gunmen followed the 2 throughout the streets at around 4 in the morning and confronted them as they passed through an intersection. The father of the victims, David Paramo, hosts a radio show and writes for the national newspaper. His wife, Martha Gonzalez, edits the local newspaper, El Peso. Although the police have not identified the gunmen, drug cartels often seek out journalists for publishing information about their activities. However, authorities claim that their death had nothing to do with the occupations of their parents. They had not yet identified any other possible motives, only noting that they were following, quote, other lines of investigation. In a separate incident, 7 bodies were found in a Mexico City suburb of El Capectec on Sunday morning. Authorities said that the victims were men and boys ranging age from 14 to 42. Mexico's drug wars have killed more than 70,000 people since 2006, when former President Felipe Calderon, in partnership with the United States, directed police and military in an armed escalation that directly targeted Mexico's cartels.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, May 6, 2013. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities and kidnap 13 Palestinians, and in Jerusalem, the Israeli government gives the green light to demolish parts of a mosque. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Family members and local activists gathered on Monday morning in front of the military court of Ofar near the central West Bank city of Ramallah in solidarity with Palestinian elected lawmaker Jamal At-Tirawi. At-Tirawi was arrested in 2006 by the Israeli army and was sentenced to 30 years in jail. 3 years ago, the Israeli occupation administration in the West Bank agreed to release him from jail, but the army still refuses the decision. Today was a court hearing to look into an appeal At-Tirawi submitted demanding his release. Earlier on Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded Beit Fajar, Al-Khadr and Beit Sahur in the West Bank districts of Bethlehem and kidnapped 13 Palestinians. Army also invaded Jenin and kidnapped 2 residents. Local news sources reported that the army invaded Beit Fajar town south of Bethlehem, broke into and searched dozens of homes and kidnapped 8 Palestinians. The army also kidnapped 3 Palestinians at a temporary roadblock installed close to Gosh Etzion settlement south of Bethlehem. Furthermore, Israeli soldiers invaded Wadi Farha area in Beit Sahur city and kidnapped 2 Palestinians. Moreover, Israeli troops invaded the town of Kabatia and Yamun near the northern West Bank city of Jenin and kidnapped 2 Palestinians on Monday. In other news, an Israeli court in Jerusalem has decided to allow the Israeli government to demolish part of a mosque despite appeals from the mosque's imam and several Palestinian members of the Israeli Knesset parliament. The Muhammad al-Fatih Mosque, located in Ras al-Amud neighborhood in East Jerusalem, was forced to expand in 2009 due to massive increase in worshippers after